What we need as a goal is to raise a generation of Christians who actually believe that truth is not a matter of opinion, that a college education, while good, is not more important than children, that a successful career, while fulfilling, is not more fulfilling than a faithful and steady marriage.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Where what we believe about who Jesus was and how he saved us influences how we treat each other all the time. Where we teach his words because he's God, whether or not we like those words. And if we don't like them, our first action is not to try to make them go away, but to find out how and why they're right. Where the good news is yelled every single day by all of us at our dinner table to our kids. Listen, God is calling.
You can listen to Pastor Fisk's presentation, Making the Case for the Church's Response to Postmodernism, on an audio DVD from the Making the Case conference. For a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day, we'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org.
Islam says that we as Muslims have to leave the environment in a better condition than we found it when we were born. In other words, Allah has entrusted to the human race the duty to improve, work with his creation. And that's why the Arkan Trust for Culture is called a trust. And that's how the ethic of the faith comes into the way you work.
That's the Aga Khan, the spiritual leader of 15 million Ismaili Muslims, speaking recently on an episode of PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly. We should listen. We really should listen when we're talking about an Islamic leader that sounds an awful lot like kind of a slightly left of center Western leader talking about the environment, caring for the environment, but all in the name of Islam. Is this movement, this Ismaili Islam, is it the reform that so many have been calling for in Islam, or even such a thing possible? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 11th of August. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be our guest. We're going to talk about the spiritual leader of 15 million Ismaili Muslims, the Aga Khan. And then we're going to be teaching a Sunday school lesson with Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel. We'll be in John chapter 12, the first 8 verses, where Mary shows her love for Jesus. And the subject will be the renewal of the Holy Spirit. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc. And our beloved on-demand listeners, feel free any place and any time you listen to use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the Aga Khan, a spiritual leader of Ismaili Muslims, Dr. Alvin Schmidt. He's professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College and author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
He sounds a lot, in some of his pronouncements, he sounds an awful lot like maybe a westernized, a very westernized Muslim, maybe even a Western political leader. Is this Aga Khan and this movement, Ismaili Islam, is this the reform that so many have been calling for in worldwide Islam?
Well, he sounds a little like Westerners, but whether he would be or his beliefs would be the reform that would be needed is another question. He's an interesting individual, and of course he represents the Ismaili Muslims, which is a sect, you mentioned 15 million. We don't really know how many millions there are. I've seen as high as 30 million. Probably 15 million is probably more close to the accurate figure. He was born in England in 1936, and he is one of many of the imams that have been around since about the 8th century. And he has a royal status. In fact, Forbes magazine a few years ago said he was the world's wealthiest royal, and he lives, even though he's a British citizen, he lives in France. He is a multi-billionaire, gets a lot of his wealth from raising special racehorses, has racetracks, and gets great tax benefits, for example, in France, which enables his wealth to continue to grow. He recently, in only last year, February 2014, he was asked to address a joint session of Canada's Parliament, which is rather unique, you might say. He also built in Toronto an elaborate, expensive museum whereby he is hoping to promote basically the philosophy of Ismaili. And so he has gained a lot of attention. But we have to remember, it's another sect within Islam. It, in some ways, is similar to the Sufis, which is another sect of Islam, smaller in number, but in some ways has been perhaps more powerful than Aga Khan's group. The Sufis, for example, to make a brief comparison, are rather a mystical group, and they believe primarily, as also the Ismailis do, in an allegorical interpretation of the Quran, and which means that the Quran in many ways would not be taken literally and hence could perhaps adopt philosophies like being more compatible to democracy if they take that approach. But at the same time, we have to remember, but both the Sufis and the Ismailis are not interested in becoming Westerners. They're very clear about that when you read some of their literature. And instead, they're basically trying to bring about a movement within that would still, however, retain basic Islamic features. The Ismailis have been accused, and Aga Khan, for example, also, of being non-Muslims. And he responds, well, we are true Muslims. Because after all, we believe in the five pillars of Islam. We read the Quran. We believe the Quran. We believe that Muhammad was the first prophet and that there won't be any others like him after his time. We, however, emphasize things that the regular Muslims don't emphasize so much. One of the things that he emphasizes is the elimination of poverty, which, of course, has attracted a lot of the Western media, thinking that here is something new and different and that maybe should be supported. So those are some of the brief outlines of what this particular sect stands for. And in their origins back in the 11th century and so on and so forth, they were basically a terrorist group and often referred to in history as the assassins. And somewhat similar to the Sufis, again, they do believe an allegorical interpretation of the Quran. And they even cite the Quran for evidence of this particular approach, which again means that they don't necessarily have to follow the Quran literally. And what the outcome of that would be if they were to get more influence in Islam, which I frankly doubt, because neither the Sunnis nor the Shiites are in favor of what he is doing. So it's a big question mark what kind of influence he has. I think primarily the West is attracted to it because they think there's something new. And I would basically think that the West is a little naive in thinking that this philosophy or Aga Khan is going to make a change in Islam.
What is Aga Khan's claimed connection to the Prophet Muhammad?
Well, simply that he believes that he was the first, the last prophet, and then no others would be following him. And as I said a moment ago, we believe in the five pillars of Islam. Now, the regular Muslims, of course, dispute that. They say he really doesn't. So therein lies the rub. And hence, the regular Muslims, the Sunnis and the Shiites, have no love for him.
How much of this is driven not by, we think of these in kind of Christian theological terms, where different confessions of faith or church bodies are divided by differences in doctrine, differences in interpretations largely surrounding things like the sacraments and whatnot, very important doctrines. But how much of are the sects of Islam divided not so much by doctrine, but in fact by claims to authority?
Yeah, you're right. That is pretty accurate. However, they will come back and say that they're really true Muslims because The Quran was not supposed to be taken literally, and that's where they cite, for example, it's in Surah 3, verses 5 and 7, where there is a hint at the Quran being able to be interpreted in a an allegorical sense, mystical sense, if you will. And that's what the Sunnis, in a sense, look to as well. And so the question is it departing from authority, or are they not departing from? I would argue they are departing from, definitely departing from the literal reading of the Quran, which most of the Sunnis and the Shiites support, rather than an allegorical or mystical thing. And as you know, the allegorical method of interpretation also was somewhat popular in the early years of the Christian church, and ultimately sort of disappeared, at least in Christianity, and I'm not so sure it's going to have a lot of merit or standing duration in the Islamic circles.
Can you explain to me, you mentioned the Aga Khan's kind of vast wealth, and that is something that is, it's something I don't understand culturally, or maybe the worldview of Islam, whereas Islam as a political system is pretty much a disaster wherever it is held, wherever is allowed to run the politics and the governing of a nation economically, human rights, in terms of human rights, in terms of relations with neighbors. It is a complete, unmitigated disaster. Then there are places, kind of westernized places like Saudi Arabia and other places, where Islam manages to coexist alongside vast wealth. Can you explain that to us as a sociologist?
Well, I don't know if I'm quite can explain it, but you mentioned, for example, in Iraq, Saudi Arabia. At the same time, why there is a certain kind of coexistence, the rules, for example, of rigid, fundamentalistic, if you want to use that term, of Islam, are more pronounced in Saudi Arabia than they are elsewhere. For instance, women are not permitted to drive a car. Women may not walk anywhere in a public sidewalk without a man accompanying her. So in that sense, my argument would be that they basically haven't accommodated or accepted Western type of philosophy, even though it's present in their midst. They tolerate it for political and economical advantage, and if push came to shove in a final analysis, they would have no love for the Westerners being in their country, which they, of course, tolerated even in the first Gulf War, and permitted us to use Riyadh in terms of an airport to strike airstrikes in Iraq when under President George Bush the First, if I may use that term. So I don't know. I think the Saudi Arabia have been very clever in giving the impression that they have not too much of a problem with the West. But at the same time, when you go to Saudi Arabia, the Westerners, for example, are not permitted to have any kind of free movement and only can go to places which are allowed officially by the government that they may see. They may not even go, for example, to Mecca if you're not a Muslim. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but I kind of like to argue that what goes on in Saudi Arabia is really not a desirable thing. It's basically a short-term. And short-term is not necessarily only a few years, but short-term in the sense that the Muslims don't expect in Saudi Arabia for this to continue forever.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about the spiritual leader of 15 million Ismaili Muslims, the Aga Khan. When we come back, we'll talk about that number of 15 million, which that's a lot of people. It is. Don't get me wrong. But in terms of the numbers of worldwide Islam, it's relatively small. We'll talk about that after this. Hollywood's attitude toward Christianity, the Bible's influence on the U.S. Constitution, the decline of biblical preaching, the connection between biblical illiteracy and Western morality. You'll find these essays and more in the new book, The Word They Still Shall Let Remain, The Place of the Holy Scriptures in the Faith and Life of Confessional Lutherans. Check it out at shop.logia.org. The Word They Still Shall Let Remain, shop.logia.org.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
Islam believes fundamentally that the spiritual and material worlds are inextricably connected. Faith is a force that should deepen our concern for our worldly habitat, for embracing its challenges, and for improving the quality of human life.
That's the voice of the Aga Khan. He's a leader of 15 million Ismaili Muslims and a sect of Islam. We're talking about him here in the first part of this hour with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. I did want to talk a little bit about the number there, because 15 million is a lot of people, but Islam is a very, very, very big force in the world when it comes to the sheer number of people. What are we talking about here, Dr. Schmidt?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. The 15 million number is probably fairly accurate, as I indicated a little while ago. At the same time, we really have heard very little in the news media about this particular group named Ismailis and Aga Khan, the present leader, which I don't quite understand. Canada has given quite a bit of attention. As I said a little while ago, they permitted him even to build a massive, expensive museum in Toronto, as well as appear in Parliament. At the same time, ordinarily, sometimes in the literature, you read more about the Sufis, which is a smaller group, but they have been in existence probably longer, although their origin has been debated in terms of when and they actually began. So I don't know. It's a difficult thing to say, given the fact that they have 15 million members, true, but they are also very widely spread across the world, so to speak. And one wonders whether, for example, primarily they are unrecognized, as I mentioned, by the media. It may be because of one man, namely Aga Khan, who, because of his wealth, has made some popular points known about them, namely that they, for example, are trying to eliminate poverty. And that, of course, has attracted somewhat the West. But still, it has not received a lot of attention, not in the literature or that I've read more. When have you heard it mentioned, for example, on the TV? I have never heard it on TV, and I may have missed it, but it's just not very commonly reported. And why, again, that remains a question. 15 million numbers apparently doesn't necessarily attract the media to zero in and tell us more about them. And so he has made some appearances here and there, but for the most part, he's been ignored.
Okay, I did want to ask about
kind of the Ismaili claim of being persecuted, which may or may not be true. I don't know the facts on that, but at least the PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly story talked about the Ismaili being persecuted by ISIS and by Al-Qaeda. Now, I want you to take that apart in two ways for us, if you would, Dr. Schmidt. First of all, these sects do tend to be persecuted by more strict Quran reading Muslims, and that we usually think about ISIS having as its primary target the West, which may, again, may well be true, but its target is also against fellow Muslims to a certain degree, isn't it?
Yes, that's true, because, again, you're coming, both of the major groups, the Shiites and the Sunnis, are basically literalists when it comes to interpreting the Quran. And when you're a literalist, the Quran, of course, as I've mentioned in previous interviews, has at least 100 violent passages, all in the present tense. And so if you have a group that is different, even within their own circles of the sect, they do not take kindly to it. And therefore, they have no love for the Aga Khan group nor for the Sufis, because both of them are basically departing from the literal interpretation of the Quran, and it's the literal interpretation of the Quran that gives ISIS the power. It gives them their justification to kill all the unbelievers, the infidels, and the followers of Aga Khan, the Ismailis, and the Sufis have not taken that tack. And so there is a conflict there, definitely speaking. The ISIS group is very similar to the Al-Qaeda group. Basically, we have to fight and win on the basis of using the sword, whereas these other two groups we're talking about, smaller and the like, have been more accommodating and less literalist, and again, takes them back to the allegorical interpretation and mystical interpretation, and sometimes emphasize love instead of force and violence. So they are obviously seen as a threat to the major Islamic groups, whether it's the Sunnis or the Shiites, and, of course, ISIS.
Then does that mean that groups like these that are the targets of ISIS or Al-Qaeda are, in some sense, allies of the West?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they have, for the most part, killed people who are Western, shall I say, sympathizers, but at the same time, they have also killed, you know, and Islam has always, from the beginning of its history, never been in a religion that has only killed outsiders. It also kills from within, and the ISIS group is just another example. If you are not following their particular philosophy, ideology, you will be killed, just as much as an unbeliever is who's never been acquainted or has never been a Muslim. So, yes, your question, I would say, is true.
Finally, then, Dr. Schmidt, you're talking to, say, a westernized Muslim, someone who has fully integrated themselves into the United States and its mores and its ideas. But they're Muslim, and they consider themselves to be a Muslim. What do they need to know about Islam worldwide?
I mean, the integrated Muslims in our society, I mean?
Yeah, what do they need to know about Islam worldwide? Because they may well be buying into and even unwittingly perpetuating this notion that then may be perpetuated also by groups like the Ismaili, that Islam in its essence is a peaceful religion.
Yeah, well, my personal understanding is of even the so-called integrated Muslim in this country, and I question that term in many ways, but we'll say one who isn't standing out conspicuously as being anti-Western, but sort of lives in this situation, does more of that because he or she really believes in a more moderate Muslim, but is basically afraid to speak out on his position. So he basically accommodates himself and does not make himself really known. See, I really don't believe you're going to find any, you haven't found it anywhere, whether it's in England or in France or in our country, of Muslims really becoming assimilated into the culture. Because the moment you do that, you're giving up a great deal of Islam. In fact, you would even have trouble, I think, or the Aga Khan group of Sufis that have trouble as well in this country to become really assimilated. They use certain kinds of language and terminology that has a familiar and acceptable ring in Western society when they say love or trying to prevent or overcome poverty. That appeals to us very quickly, but ultimately they still, deep down inside, are going to be following the Quran. And if you follow the Quran, even if you don't always follow it literally, you're not going to become an assimilated American or Canadian or in England or wherever. You will still always stand out as a foreigner that does not want to accept the West, because there's too many things in Western society that have a Christian influence, even though we are secular, that they do not want to identify with or have part of their particular lifestyle.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He is author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can find out more about this book at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.